2WBAI.org online. Okay, now stay tuned for Off the Hook, and the time now is 7 p.m.
Regret that the number you have dialed is disconnected or unavailable. For further information, please call International Directory Assistance on 1225.
Thank you for listening to Off the Hook.
Well, first of all, I want to thank everyone for showing up for my talk. It's great to be back home again. And I want to thank everyone for all their support they've given me over the years. And today, my talk is going to be a little bit different. I usually talk for companies and conventions and stuff like that, but I'm going to talk about me and the stuff that I've been through and where I'm going and some entertaining stories I think everyone will relate to and enjoy. And I guess I am the only first hacker to bring my mom and grandmother to a conference, so it's kind of interesting. Anyway, I think I was born... Oh, by the way, my talk is going to last for about probably an hour, 15 minutes to an hour and a half, then I'm going to have a 30-minute Q&A, just so everyone's aware of the time constraints here. I think I was born as a hacker because at 10 years old, I was fascinated with magic. I love illusions. And I would hang out at the corner magic store for hours and hours just to find out the secret to a magic trick. I always wanted a bite of the forbidden fruit, the forbidden apple, and I always was in pursuit of information that should be secret, but for entertainment. I loved doing illusions. I loved pulling pranks on friends and family. So about 2 years later, the first system I hacked wasn't a computer, wasn't a telephone, but was the Los Angeles RTD. You know what RTD is? The Rapid Transit District. So as a young kid, my hobby was riding buses. I used to like ride buses around all the way through Los Angeles and San Bernardino. My mom worked long hours as a single mother supporting me, so Kevin had to find something entertaining to do. So one day I'm sitting at the back of the bus, and I'm looking at the transfer. You know how you could pay a certain fee and you can buy a transfer to transfer on a different line? I'm looking at it, and it has a special punch, and it's punched with the date and the direction you're going, and you could use this as a ticket to get on the next bus. So I'm thinking to myself, about 11 and a half years old, this is kind of interesting. So I go up to the bus driver as I'm about to get off the bus, and I go, "Hey, sir, where do you get these punches? I'm doing a special project for school, and I like the kind of shapes these are. These are really cool shapes. Where can I buy one of these punches?" And he told me the name of the store in downtown Los Angeles. I guess that was the first time I did social engineering, 11 years old. So I go to the store in downtown LA, and I buy myself a nice shiny punch. And I go, "Wow, this is cool. I can punch my own transfers." Problem was, is I didn't have any transfers. So I was thinking, my grandmother lived about 2 miles away from the RTD bus depot. And I was thinking, you know, human nature, people are lazy. So I think these bus drivers, probably after a long day of riding that bus, they take these transfers they haven't used and they just throw it in the trash. So Kevin at 11 and a half became a dumpster diver. And I went into the RTD trash and fished out all these blank transfers. And I used to punch my own transfers and ride the bus system. Bus drivers knew what I was doing because they'd see me boarding the bus and I'd have the outline of the punch, right? And I'd be so bold sometimes to punch another transfer on the bus for somebody else. And the driver thought it was cute, right? Everyone thought it was cute. No one told me I was defrauding RTD, right? And I guess I have a little bit of photographic memory because I actually ended up memorizing the entire schedule for every bus in Los Angeles County. So if I knew I had to go from point A to point B, I knew what time to be at what place without referencing any type of schedule. So that was kind of interesting. One day I was riding the bus and I met this other guy who was a ham radio operator. And this bus driver says, hey kid, I found this radio on the back of a bus. Do you know what it is? And he held up an HT, Motorola HT, and I go, "Oh, that's a police radio," I'm thinking. "Well, that's cool. I'd like to listen to the police." And he goes, "No, this is a ham radio." So he introduced me to the hobby of amateur radio. And I was so intrigued, not with the radio, but of the auto patch capability. That's making phone calls over radio. I thought the auto patch was cool. I could have this little HT handheld. This is like 20 years ago, and I could dial any phone number. And I thought that was, wow, I want to be able to do that. Right? So I won't go into my auto patch stories. That'll be for the next talk. But the most fun I had with radio, before I get into phones and computers, was the drive-up windows at McDonald's. Because you could clip a wire in some sort of certain radios, like the Elinco radio, and you can go out of band and transfer on any transmit on any frequency. So we used to have fun at McDonald's. So the customer drive up to the drive-up window, and we now become the McDonald's employee because we have more power. "Can I take your order, sir?" "Yes, I'd like a Big Mac, large fry, large Coke." "Oh, I'm sorry, we have changed our menu, and now we offer Super Taco, burritos, and we don't offer any sodas anymore. It's only juices." We drive customers crazy. Even to the point, and don't forget, we're young at this time, right? So we're a little bit crazy. We actually, with a microcassette tape recorder, record ourselves, like, well, one of us recorded ourselves urinating in the toilet, so you have the sound on tape. Driver comes up. "Yes, sir, may I help you?" "Yes, I'd like to get a Big Mac and a large soda." "Well, sir, we only have apple juice today, and our ice machine's broken. But we could get you a large apple juice, and it's on the house. Would you like that?" "Oh, yes, sir, okay." "Well, hold on, is that small, or, you know, small, medium, or large?" And we play the tape, right? We drove one McDonald's so crazy that the manager came out. We're like a block away doing this, right? Manager comes out. He's looking in the parking lot. He sees no one, right? And he's looking around, and he's scratching his head, and he walks up to the speaker, right? And he has his face on the speaker, and I go, "What the F are you looking at?" This guy, this guy jumped back 30 feet. Don't tell the FCC on me. They already don't like me. So let's fast forward a little bit to high school.
From the archives of the HOPE Conference, July 9th, 2004, Kevin Mitnick in his first appearance at a hacker conference giving a talk about what it was all about all those years. We lost Kevin on July 16th of this year to pancreatic cancer. And it's been a real shock to so many people around the world. And we're going to be talking about about Kevin tonight. We're going to be remembering Kevin. For overtime, following this show on YouTube, you have the opportunity to call in if you have any memories or thoughts that you'd like to share as well. I want to welcome everybody. This is Manuel. Kyle's here.
Yeah, I'm right here.
We have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
And Alex.
Good evening, everyone.
That news, although somewhat expected, was still extremely shocking, surprising, dismaying, and I think everybody in the community has felt that.
Absolutely. The loss of Kevin has it's reverberated throughout the community since word of it started getting out. And we have seen such a swell of support and fond memories and everything on various social media, on Twitter, on Mastodon, on Lemmy. It's just been like there are so many in our community who knew of Kevin as sort of this cause to rally around in the old days, the whole Free Kevin movement and everything else. But there were also those in our community who have had the chance to see him speak, to speak with him, to meet him, to work with him. It was always a joy. He was a great guy to be around, above and beyond the significance that his life had to the hacker community. He was just a totally decent dude, and he's going to be very missed by very many.
Oh, absolutely. Alex, did you have something?
Yeah, I mean, I have, I guess, so many different memories and thoughts about Kevin Mitnick, because when I first came into contact with the name Kevin Mitnick, he was already a legend, I think, and it was probably around 1994, and I remember the first Hope Conference, right, when he was a wanted man.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the greatest things, I hope people still have these too, but I don't know if you did this, Emmanuel, or so, whoever did it was brilliant, but they made these face masks of Kevin Mitnick.
Oh yeah, I remember those.
And everybody was, walking around the conference with a face mask of Kevin Mitnick on it, and I remember thinking, wow, that is so cool, right?
But the reason behind that was because he was on the run. I was talking to him pretty regularly at that point, didn't know where he was, and the feds were looking for him. And, of course, they were looking for him at the very first massive hacker conference, which was the Hope Conference. Over 1,000 hackers gathered in one place. That never happened before. And you knew they were looking for Kevin, so what better way to mess with their heads for everybody to wear a Kevin Mitnick mask?
It was pretty funny. And then I think my first actual interaction with him was when he was a wanted man. He was on the run. And you would patch me into like a conference call or something where he was on the line. I don't know if you even remember this. But
I shouldn't have done that.
You probably shouldn't.
You were probably underage at the time, and I was corrupting your mind with. Yeah,
no doubt.
And look what became of you. You became a lawyer.
Yeah, nobody. Let me tell you. It's what happens. But I remember thinking, like, oh my God, that was just so cool. I said hello to Kevin Mitnick once, when he was on the road. It was a very neat experience for somebody like 15, 16 years old. And then, of course, he was caught. I don't want to jump ahead in the story, but he was caught and sentenced and spent time in, I guess it was federal prison, I believe, right?
And can I say one thing? You said caught and sentenced as if those two things happened anywhere near each other. It was years before he was sentenced after he was caught.
Yeah, it was a long time. But during that time, the Free Kevin movement was really extraordinary, and it was another thing that you did, Manuel. And I think that the image of the yellow bumper sticker, kind of yellowish orange bumper sticker with the black lettering of Free Kevin mm-hmm. on it, is still iconic to this day.
Yeah, I remember conversations we had while we were starting that. I had some involvement in activism in the past, and it was my feeling that no, nobody's going to know who Kevin was when you say Free Kevin, because the argument was, okay, we have to put a website there so people can, or explain what the case is. You can't do that on a bumper sticker. Basically, what you want to do is just get that phrase out so people start asking, who's Kevin? And that's what happened. People started asking who Kevin was, and Free Kevin became kind of a mantra. There were some black bumper stickers, too, that had the website. In fact, he's holding one of those in one of our covers of 2600, I believe in 95. It was just a really weird time because all these people around the world started getting involved because they identified with somebody who was basically being demonized the way Kevin was being demonized, and blamed for everything that went wrong with technology, with telephones, with computers. And basically, you could see why he was running for so long, because the way they treated him afterwards, after he was actually caught in 1995, they put him in solitary confinement. They basically did not sentence him for years. He eventually got out in 2000. But what we were trying to find out when we were making our documentary, Freedom Downtime, was, what is it that he did? What are you alleging that he did? And that was a question we kept asking so many people. And we never got a straight answer. We just got people saying, this is what he could have done. This is the potential. This is why he's dangerous. And it's kind of a microcosm of how hackers are treated as a community, as people, as the threat. You still read it to this day in news stories about some horrible security snafu where everybody's private information is suddenly exposed. But the story always goes, a hacker could have done this, or a hacker could get access to it. Never mind hackers, anybody could get access to it. The worst criminals in the world, the worst terrorists in the world, hackers are likely the ones that will discover it and patch the holes. And that was the point that I think all of us were trying to make at that period in time. And Kevin, he really, you know, victim that he was of this ignorance, of this hostility towards intelligent people, he got that message. He knew that there was a bigger battle going on, and he really he was so strong, you know. He had so much taken from him. He lost so much of his life behind the walls when he really should have been out there sharing his knowledge, sharing his skills, which eventually he was able to do. And I was so happy to see him able to prosper like that. But it made me angry because of all the years that he wasn't allowed to do that. And I only hope that through his, the tragedy that he lived through, maybe others were spared. Maybe some prosecutor somewhere said, this is not the right way to go. I don't know. You would probably know better than me, Alex, if that's even possible. But he definitely was not as angry as I would have been, having gone through all of that. I mean, perhaps inside he was, but he was so gracious, so sharing, so giving. And I think that's how we'll always remember Kevin.
Yeah, I tend to agree. He was a great guy. I remember one night when we all hung out. I think it was a junior's or something, right? Didn't we go out for cheesecake or something like that?
That would have been the right thing to do.
Yeah,
I'm sure we did.
Yeah, I think it was juniors, and it was really the first time that I had, you know, hung out with him. As a person, I remember thinking, you know, what a great guy. It's just a good dude. And he became also kind of famous for his business cards. Do you remember the business cards that he used to hand out?
Rob is holding one up right now. Rob, describe that business card to us.
Okay, first for the listeners, I'll flick it with my finger, and you can hear this.
Don't hurt yourself.
This is a metal business card, but not only is it a metal business card, it is a set of lockpicks, basically, that you could pop out of the frame here, and you have a set of lockpicks. And it's also his real business card. It's got, you know, his name, address, contact info, and everything for his for Mitnick Security Consulting. And these became sort of coveted in the hacker scene. You can find pictures of these online if you look around. And Yeah, they were great, and it's just one example of the, like, just the spirit he had and the sense of fun around around the things he did.
Yeah, I've been taking a lot of this time to reflect a little bit, and those were some of the mementos. He was always handing them out, and I just remember learning about his story through things like Freedom Downtime, and really growing around some of the real life stories that hacking and the news and you know that were going on in real life. Because I think a lot of that prior to that, I mean, with the fictional movie hackers, like a lot of the way the media was like sensationalizing and kind of remystifying this whole identity. As a young person, realizing that, okay, actually there are people that get accused of this kind of stuff. They get labeled this way and they actually suffer real consequences. And then, you know, sort of watching the documentary and realizing, wow, this isn't anything like what you would see in the movies or what the media wants you to think of these, this sort of scary caricature of what we come to understand of as hacking, which is you know, people that are really passionate, people that evangelize and share about what they know and yearn with a fierce curiosity to understand how things work, whether it's a magic trick or whatever other system they're facing. So it's been just great to hear other people's stories about Kevin and how they've sort of come to know him and what kind of impact it's had on their trajectory and what they've been doing. And I think, yeah, his story is going to live on in so many ways. And it's been a bit jarring, and it makes you kind of also get a little deep and stuff about, you know, health and looking in on others and making sure that, you know, you do your best out there. But, yeah, he bore so much, pain, I think, through, incarceration and standing up, I think, just for himself and putting even his own skill and acumen when he was on the run to, his own self-preservation, knowing he was right, you know, deep down that, you know, this was being, totally blown out of proportion, just out of the survival instinct there. I mean, it's emblematic, I think, of what a lot of hackers, feel deep down when they're, feeling, confronted and threatened by different systems or, just by merely knowing something, and then trying to get a story out, it can be a real battle. So
now, because it has been a couple of decades since that part of Kevin's story and the whole Free Kevin movement, I think it's safe to say that not everyone out there listening and not everyone in our community knows what it was all about anymore. But I think Emmanuel, you can claim a great deal of the credit for publicizing that, for first getting that out there and getting the movement going. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what that was like for you at the beginning.
Well, I mean, I don't think I get the credit for it. I think the credit goes to all the people who responded, because, you know, we talk about a lot of things. We're always talking about some cause or some injustice. But if people don't respond to it, then it remains an injustice. And I think it's the reason that this basically, that Kevin's life changed. It's because of our communities, because people responded and stood up and literally demonstrated in streets all around the world. You know, in Moscow, there were demonstrations. In Los Angeles, there were demonstrations. Chicago, everywhere, there were demonstrations. It was incredible to see that. And we were just able to use technology, use various skills, make a film, get on the radio. WBAI is massively responsible for helping to get the word out. And I don't know. It just there were many stories of injustice at the time. There was fiber optic. There was Bernie S. There seemed to be a lot of things going on in the mid 90s for some reason. And of course, there still are today. There's all kinds of other injustices, and some of them are much, much worse. But I just think the stars aligned. I think that's really what it was. We had a magazine. We, you know, had the desire and ability to tell a story and actually interview people and go across the country and try and document this story. And of course, there was the movie that was coming out that we were protesting, Takedown. Do you remember that? That was basically what had happened was Hollywood had decided to make a movie about Kevin's life without consulting Kevin, to the degree where he was still sitting in jail, in prison, not even being sentenced. No idea what the future was going to be. I can't describe, I can't imagine the kind of hell that is, but he was living it. And that was a problem for the screenwriters as well, you know, because, well, how do you tell the story if there's no sentence? So they basically, they made him guilty. They said, okay, he was found guilty in a trial that never happened, and he was sentenced. So they just kind of made that up. And we thought that was rather unfair, and that was, I think, the final motivating factor. So, you know, I got to give those people who wrote that horrible screenplay and made that horrible movie, which eventually came out. It didn't come out in this country for a number of years. It did come out and was widely panned, and that's a nice word for it. Had it not been for that terrible action of theirs, maybe we wouldn't have been so angry. We would have been angry, but not as angry as that, because, boy, you know, you're basically writing fiction about somebody's real life when they're sitting in prison. It just was so wrong. And somehow, and I'd like to think that we still have this ability, we were able to get copies of every single revision of the script. So every time they made a change, we found out about it. It drove them crazy. how were the hackers finding out about this film and the new scene that even the actors don't know about yet? It was really kind of crazy. What's funny is Takedown was being filmed in North Carolina, because that's where a lot of Hollywood productions are filmed. And North Carolina happened to be the state that Kevin Mitnick had been caught in 1995. So there were all these parallels. We were able to go down there and talk to the people making the film and then take a drive and see Kevin's apartment where he had been caught. There were just all these weird coincidences that were happening. It just, you know, it felt like this is what we have to be doing at this point in time. And I hope that listeners and other people in the hacker community see themselves in a similar light. Like, they're in the right place at the right time, and they are the right person to be doing something of significance. And even though other people will say it's not going to make any difference, it's a waste of time, you do it anyway. You do it anyway because it will make a difference. You might not even feel it immediately. It might take years, decades, maybe even past your lifetime. But I guarantee it's going to matter. It's going to mean something. And just being able to see Kevin come out of prison in January of 2000, and literally the day after he was released from prison, we were sued by the motion picture people for having DECSS. It was like a TV show that went from one chapter to another. So yeah, the synchronicity was something to behold.
You know, I want to go back to the protests for a moment. Do you remember? I guess it might have been 1997, 1998 when we had the protest in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm, I remember very well.
In federal court, it was in front of the federal courts, so down in Pearl Street. Where, by the way, I was in that building today. That's why listeners can't see me, but I'm wearing a suit because I was actually in federal court today. Where I, just about 25 years ago, I can't believe it was that long. Was it that long? It was longer, actually. Well, no, it was about 25 years ago.
1998 was 25 years ago.
Oh, my God. That's crazy. Anyhow, where we were 25 years ago, when I was in college, before I was a lawyer, And this was a really formative experience for me because we all came together. We had free Kevin banners. We were over there. People didn't know what the hell we were talking about or what we were doing. And we had flyers that we were handing out about his case that people were actually reading. We were making people change their minds. They were on our side. But do you remember, Emmanuel, the day was hot as hell. It was such a hot day, right? And we kept and this was something I thought was really just kind of that magical that happened while we were protesting that day was we kept going back and buying drinks from the same hot dog guy that was outside the federal courts.
That's right, yes.
And we, you know, we befriended him in a sense, and he came to trust me for a little while with his cart. He actually asked me to watch over his hot dog cart because he had to run out for a few minutes. So I thought, okay, sure, I'll watch your cart. And I thought maybe, you know, I'll give the guy a rest. He can go and use the bathroom, you know, the whatever he has to do. But he was gone for a while. Right? And remember, I was over there at the cart, and the protest is going on, and there's people coming up to me trying to buy hot dogs and things like that from me. And so now I'm just watching the cart, you know, and so many people started coming up to me. I wound up starting to sell them drinks so I could figure that out, and then ultimately hot dogs, and then handed the guy money when he came back. And so I had said to him, I said, you know, where did you go? You were gone for like, you know, 20 minutes, a half an hour or something. And he said, well, I went to pray. You know, he said, you know, I thought you guys looked trustworthy and I could leave you with my cart. And so I took the opportunity that I don't usually have during the day, and I went to pray.
Wow.
Because he was Muslim. And I thought, oh, my God, that's extraordinary. Here we are, a whole bunch of hackers hanging out and protesting at the federal court. And this is the guy, and he trusted us. This guy trusted us with his livelihood. I thought there was something magical about that. And then we even got some pictures of him with Free Kevin stickers, and it became part of the archives. He's forever memorialized as well. But I think it's just emblematic of a lot of the magic that happened around these types of demonstrations, these protests, these things. And I think you're selling yourself short, Emmanuel. I think you are in very large part responsible for energizing all this. Sure, we may have shown up, but you put it together. You were the organizer, and I think you taught us a hell of a lot about what it means to stand up for what you believe in.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And we have some listener response from Stanley, who says, I really was not sure where to properly mourn Kevin's passing, so I thought Off the Hook would be the appropriate place. I first started reading 2600 magazine when I was 10 years old in early 1993. Both the magazine and Kevin's hacks, social engineering, and later documentaries on his legal case really served as personal inspiration for years. By age 13, I was learning about telecommunications hardware and CPU architecture. I briefly interned at AOL Time Warner in the early 2000s even, but ultimately decided to work in another profession. Wise move, Stanley. This is such a sad day, Kevin. You will be missed, and you had a tremendous impact on so many lives. That's certainly true. That's certainly true. And this is from Jerry. Dear Off the Hook, my deepest condolences to you all for the death of your friend, Kevin Mitnick. One of my most cherished Hope Conference memories was attending the screening of Freedom Downtime. From start to finish of the film, I was on the edge of my seat. Emmanuel's narration was pitch perfect, and to this day, it remains one of my favorite documentaries. I don't know about pitch perfect, but thank you for that. That's very, very kind. The New York Times ran a very detailed obituary. In fact, they ran an obituary and said at the bottom they were going to run a more complete one. I didn't really believe them, but they did. They actually ran this 3-4 page obituary about Kevin's life with many, many details. The original mini obituary, I guess you could call it, inspired our friend Greg Newby to write a piece to the New York Times. I'd like to read that piece since they didn't print that, and you wouldn't hear it otherwise. Dear Times, I write in reference to your coverage of the death of Kevin Mitnick. The article indicates a complete obituary will follow. I strongly encourage the Times to cover its own role in the Kevin Mitnick story. To fail to do so would effectively ignore or whitewash how the Times, particularly its longtime journalist John Markoff, was involved in Kevin's eventual capture and incarceration. The story in a nutshell is that without the tenacity of John Markoff and the support of the Times editorial staff, Mitnick would have been far less likely to be subject to the extraordinary pursuit that led to his eventual incarceration. The hyperbolic news coverage of the Times, augmented by inflated statements of risk and damages by prosecutors and the businesses Mitnick targeted, elevated the manhunt far beyond what it otherwise would have been. The situation is addressed to some extent in the obituary, which seems to have been written by friends and colleagues, can be found on a website called dignitymemorial.com. It is more thoroughly addressed in Mitnick's 1996 book with Jonathan Littman, The Fugitive Game, the book about Mitnick, that is, The Fugitive Game. Compare this to the book Markoff wrote with Tsutomu Shimomura, Takedown. In reading both books side by side with the Times coverage of the day, it is evident that Mitnick's exploits, though criminal, were neither malicious nor especially impactful. After Mitnick was captured, some of the main players in the prosecution, or from the companies who were said to have damaged, spoke out for leniency for Mitnick. The punishment did not fit the crime. The story of the Times' involvement is that it was the Times, not the prosecutor, who targeted companies, targeted companies or law enforcement, that elevated Mitnick to the world's most dangerous hacker. In other words, the Times did that. A series of articles written by Markoff ensured the pursuit of Mitnick continued long after the main events in question. In the books and news coverage of Mitnick's capture on February 15, 1995, including the Times article, we find that Shimomura and Markoff were actually part of the FBI's pursuit operation. In fact, if I could just step out of this for a second, I later found out that my phone conversations with Kevin were being listened to by John Markoff and Tsutomu Shimomura as they were trying to track him down. It goes above and beyond what journalism is when you're helping the FBI in tracking down somebody. But that's exactly what was happening. And my conversations were being eavesdropped upon by people who were not law enforcement. It was very interesting and documented in both books, both The Fugitive Game and Takedown. You'll see that. So it was really kind of a bizarre thing to realize that while we were conversing, they were trying to track him down further, and eventually they did. Continuing here, the perspective of the Times' involvement in creating and perpetrating Mitnick's infamy isn't a corner conspiracy theory. It has been widely covered by the mainstream media, including an article in Forbes in 1999, I believe. With Mitnick's death, the Times has an opportunity to revisit how its important role as a gatekeeper of the news can sometimes result in inflated and hyperbolic coverage of events. In Kevin Mitnick's case, coverage by the Times helped create a perception of risk from Mitnick's behavior far in excess of reality. Thanks for your consideration in this matter. Signed, Greg Newby. Greg, I know that they did not print what you wanted them to print, but I'm glad you wrote that. I'm glad we got to share that with people. And the truth needs to be told.
Yeah, I think that's a really a very strong notion that journalists everywhere ought to heed, especially when cultivating sources, because that behavior it is a form of temptation that I think compromises the integrity that that sources trusting you would expect, and of course also doing the bidding of what is ultimately in the interests of big business. That isn't necessarily, I mean, that may serve their interests, but isn't serving the kind of reporting that needs to be done in that situation. You're sort of taking sides and then going on a mission for what that interest may want. You may feel like a hero in that process, but you're not really doing heroic journalism. So.
No, certainly true there. I just want to tell one other story that isn't really remembered all that much, but it's kind of fascinating because it's how we found out that Kevin was on the run in the first place. A bunch of us were at a conference in Chicago. This was in March of 1994. Late March of 1994. It was called CFP, Computers, Freedom, and Privacy. It would take place in different cities throughout the country year after year. Good conference. And it was one of these conferences where you got to talk to people from law enforcement. And I remember there was this guy from the FBI. I think his name was Jim Settle. He was the FBI guy that was basically on panels and kind of sharing his perspective. In the middle of the night, on one of the nights that we were all out there, three people got arrested or detained or basically questioned aggressively. Robert Steele was one of them, the late Robert Steele, who was our first keynote speaker. Two other young people were also arrested or detained or questioned. It turned out this had to do with the hunt for Kevin Mitnick. And it's a reminder to those of you out there, the FBI is always on duty. You know, they may pretend to be on a panel at a conference, but they're watching and they're acting. And that's exactly what happened at this conference, except they messed it up so badly. It was comical. There is a radio show. We did a radio show. Look it up on 2600.com where we keep all our radio shows. The end of March, 1994, you will find, I think we talked to everybody who was involved, who had been questioned. That is, Robert Steele was questioned because his last name was Steele, and they were looking for a hacker known as Agent Steele. It was spelled differently, S-T-E-A-L, not S-T-E-E-L-E, but the FBI thought maybe there was a connection there, so they basically talked to this guy. They talked to another guy who resembled Agent Steele. His name was Justin Peterson, who was also passed away. And then they talked to a third person who resembled physically Kevin Mitnick. Had nothing to do with Kevin Mitnick, but just looked a little bit like him, and that was enough. Yeah, and so that's how we found out that Kevin was, in fact, being sought by the FBI. They really blew it. They really made a mess out of the whole thing, and it was very embarrassing. It resulted in a lot of distrust and bad feelings, but one hell of a story that we should not forget. Another excerpt that I'd like to go back to. This is the day that Kevin Mitnick was captured in Raleigh, North Carolina. And what's interesting is that we were doing a show on Wednesday, February 15th, 1995. And we had the story before anybody else had the story. I had been talking to Kevin. I didn't know where he was. Didn't want to know where he was, but I had found out that he had been captured very early that morning. As the radio show was airing, the New York Times was being printed and had come out by the time we were off the air, and it was front page news again. And that's part of the whole thing, the fact that it was front page news throughout. That's why Kevin Mitnick was always somebody that the FBI and authorities were so keen on capturing, because well, when it's on the front page and you're not finding the guy, you look bad. So they redoubled all their efforts. Let's just listen to the first 5 minutes of that show, February 15th, 1995, Off the Hook.
And a good evening, everybody. This is Off the Hook, the program that deals with the dreaded term of cyberspace and all kinds of other fun things going on the net community. The telephone world, the hacker world, the big brother Orwellian future that lies ahead for all of us. And tonight we have some rather sad news in the world of cyberspace, as it were, in the world of hackers. This is something that has not yet gone out over the wires, because I don't think the wires know about it yet, but after tonight they will. Early this morning, Kevin Mitnick was apprehended, Kevin Mitnick being the hacker who was on the run for at least a year, and this happened as a result, starting with a parole violation, probation violation last year. If you recall, we had a show focusing on on what happened in Chicago at a convention called Computers, Freedom, and Privacy, where the Federal Bureau of Investigation investigated three wrong people, including a former CIA operative, thinking that they were on the trail of both Kevin Mitnick and Agent Steele, Justin Peterson, who was someone working for the FBI at one point who was trying to entrap hackers and then went on the run himself and was committing all kinds of crimes. So they caught up with Agent Steele not too long after that, but Kevin Mitnick always remained one step ahead, sometimes two steps ahead, up until this morning when he was apprehended in, from what I hear, North Carolina, our favorite state. And that's really all we know right now. We know this happened at about, I think, 3 in the morning our time. And what's funny about all this is that I just talked to him only a couple of days ago. Actually, I was talking to him fairly recently before he actually got apprehended. And it's kind of a sad thing when you're talking to somebody that's on the run like that, because you know, there are so many things that they want to do that it just can't do. They can't hang out publicly. They can't go to meetings or see anybody that they might be expected to see. They pretty much have to live a rented car, motel, fast food life. And that's sort of what Kevin was doing. I never asked him where he was. I didn't want to know. I only hoped deep down within me that he had left the country. Obviously, he didn't. I know a few weeks ago, there was a very close call in Seattle where he almost got picked up, and I think he somehow found out about it a half hour afterwards. He basically missed them by about a half hour, and they were very frustrated by that. And one thing I tried to tell Kevin was that these people are very, very good at what they do. You have to keep that in mind. Somehow, they're able to find people if they grow facial hair or get a nose job or something. If you get your picture in the paper or on America's Most Wanted, they somehow figure out that it's you anyway. You know? When's the last time you heard of the FBI not finding somebody? Well, there was Abbie Hoffman, of course, but I think he was the only person that was able to do it and pull it off successfully. Everybody, especially today, with cameras all over the place. You know, you never know when you're being looked at. Actually, you never know when you're not being looked at these days, because most of the time you're being looked at somewhere. And that's the kind of world that Kevin Mitnick had to live in and not be recognized. It could only last for so long. I think we all knew it was going to end at some point, and I had this gut feeling that it was going to be soon, because it just seemed like things were reaching a crescendo. And when you're on the run for so long, you kind of get sloppy after a while. You kind of don't think to cover your trail quite as neatly. And I was worried that he was calling, and that I was talking to him. You know, if my phone was tapped, maybe they could do a trace. If he was talking to me, maybe he was talking to other people. It was rather sad to think of it in that way. Now, you might ask, well, this guy's a criminal. You know, how can you talk to someone like that? How can you harbor a fugitive? Well, of course, that's nonsense. Kevin is as much a criminal as any of us, I think. Basically, his crime is knowledge, and I think that's something that really, really frightens people, and certainly frightens governments, agencies, people in power. Because here's a guy that can do virtually anything on a network involving computers, involving the phone system. Admittedly, he's very good at what he does. Admittedly, he's very good at getting information. And that makes people in high places very, very nervous. No question about that. But is the guy a criminal worthy of being locked up? I don't think so. And when you think of what is in store for him, you really, really have to wonder if playing by the rules makes any sense at all these days.
From the Off the Hook archives, February 15th, 1995, the day that Kevin Mitnick was captured in Raleigh, North Carolina. And those moments where we told the world about that. And yeah, you know, you kind of realize why somebody would run for so long and be determined not to be captured because of what happened to him after that, of the years that were taken from him because of that. And maybe we can understand why people run when the cops say stop, you know, or why people don't just give themselves up and assume that they're going to get a fair trial when it's obvious they won't. There are so many instances of that that we have seen, that we continue to see. And Kevin lived that life. We only have a couple of minutes left. I want to invite people to join us on Overtime at 8 o'clock, which will be on our YouTube channel, which is Channel 2600. It's one word, Channel 2600. Or you can just click on the link on the 2600.com webpage up there on the top. I'd like to open it up to Rob, Alex, Kyle, if you have any closing thoughts on Kevin. We have about 2 minutes.
Just, he was very young. It's devastating to lose him so young. And, the best we can do is remember him and remember him well.
And I think he's going to live on and a lot of us, and I think all of us that have met him have had the benefit of his friendship, of his tutelage, and his memory. I think his memory will serve, I hope, as a comfort and a blessing to so many of us in the community for a very, very long time to come. This is a guy who started in very, very humble origins in California, and despite, you know, maybe some questionable activities here and there, I mean, he changed the world with his life. He changed our attitudes, and he made an impact on this world that I think is, you know, larger than the size of the crater of the Grand Canyon. He led an extraordinary life. It was cut short by cancer, pancreatic cancer, something that's so unforgiving and so unrelenting. But I think he'll be with us in many, many ways for many, many years to come. And I think we need to celebrate his life, his perseverance, and his philosophy, as well as being a prankster, being a jokester, being somebody who memorizes bus tables, figures things out, shares the information with the community. He embodies the true spirit of a hacker in so many ways. He'll be missed.
I just want to thank everyone who has shared and is keeping his memory alive with their recounting, and tell other people, tell what you recall and your interactions, if you had some directly or sharing his story. But I want to thank Kevin, you know, for being who he was, for standing up for himself and just sharing what he knew and sharing his time with us. And really giving back as much as he could to the community, and I share the sentiment. I wish he had been able to age and be with us much longer. He deserved that for having so much time taken from him.
Absolutely.
In our view, unjustly. But we'll keep his memory alive, and we'll share some more, I think, as the days and weeks go.
As if this story couldn't get any sadder, word is out that he was going to be a father. A child he will never meet, but Kevin will live on in that way, and that's something. All right, we will see you on YouTube at 8 o'clock for Overtime. Kevin was a wanted man for a number of years, but he later became a wanted man of a different sort. Everybody wanted him to speak at their event or their company and share his unique knowledge, and we're all so much better off knowing him.
Wanted man in California, wanted man in Buffalo, wanted man in Kansas City, wanted man in Ohio, wanted man in Mississippi, wanted man in Old Cheyenne. Wherever you might look tonight, you might see this wanted man. I might be in Colorado or Georgia by the sea, working for some man who may not know at all who I might be. If you ever see me coming, and if you know who I am, don't you breathe it to nobody,
cause you know I'm on the lam. Wanted man by Lucy Watson. Wanted man by Jeannie Brown. Wanted man by Nellie Johnson. Wanted man in this Texas town. But I've had all that I wanted of a lot of things I had, and a lot more than I needed of something that turned out bad. Get myself a map, went the wrong way into Juarez with Juanita on my lap. Then I went to sleep in Shreveport, woke up in Abilene, wondering why the hell I'm wanted at some town halfway between. Wanted man in Albuquerque, wanted man in Syracuse, wanted man in man in Baton Rouge. There's somebody set to grab me anywhere that I might be, and wherever you might look tonight, you might get a glimpse of me. Wanted man in California, wanted man in Buffalo, wanted man in Kansas City, wanted man in Ohio, wanted man.
This is Ralph Pointer. Join me and others every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. It would appear the human movement is such that at any moment in history, there are too few that understand possibilities of existence that would benefit all who inhabit this planet and are willing to act on this understanding. This program will feature that few. What are your views on these issues that impact your life today? What are your views on America today? What are your views on America's future? Can we talk? Call in 212-209-2877. Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 on your radio.